Morning comes a bit early for some people here, so I think I'll take a couple moments to get a sense of who's here and allow maybe some latecomers to walk in. I'm Rick Burnett from Florida State University, and I'm one of the names up there, and we actually have a third, Stuart Sim, who will be joining us today for the presentation. So we can have a little bit of a sense of who we're speaking to. I'd like to get a sense, how many of you are specifically in database administration, warehousing, or something of that nature? If you can, show me your hands, okay? How many people fit or consider yourselves on the functional side of the house in some way, shape, or form, doing reporting, again, for a functional office or something like that? All right, okay, go ahead. All right, how many of you raised your hand twice already? Okay. And then how many would be IT administrators? Okay. How many raised your hand? Three times now. Okay. That's good. We have some people wearing many hats today. And anybody else just a technologist interested in technology? All right. So we have a good mix, but it seems like we have a lot of people have a fair bit of knowledge about business intelligence and reporting. And so I think that we'll take that in mind as we go through the presentation this morning and try not to speak to the lowest common denominator. Maybe we'll try to raise up and speak to most of the class. The objectives this morning are basically to provide an overview of some of the landscape of reporting and how it may be affected by SOA. And as you saw, maybe or probably saw on the first slide or down here in the bottom corner, this presentation is given by a group of people who have been associated with the Quality Student Project. And part of what we're doing is we're trying to find out how to leverage technologies, how to leverage service-oriented architecture, and what that means to us in terms of reporting and systems design. So as it relates to this particular presentation, we want to look at the change in reporting needs that we would hope that a new student information system might be able to accommodate. We want to talk about the architectural constraints that we're trying to address in terms of our design, and then discuss the unique opportunities that these structures that we'll create or that we are creating will provide for us in terms of reporting flexibility. So let's talk about the evolution of reporting. Back in Mesopotamia, okay, never mind. Well, maybe we'll fast forward. We won't give you the whole evolution of reporting from the cave walls, but let me go as somebody who has historically come from the enrollment management side of the house. I've spent 26 years in enrollment management. What I've seen, one of the drivers to the Quality Student Project and looking for the next generation student information system was a change in requirements and needs for the institutions. And so what we found is as the university started moving towards a more formalized enrollment management paradigm, instead of having a bunch of stovepipe type functional operations and concordant stovepipe systems, we wanted to start meeting as a group and collectively address enrollment and retention on campus. And so what we found early on, and for Florida State University, this was back around, I'd say about 1998 is when we really formalized everything, that the initial responses were that, I get a sense that we have more students from Florida than other states. And that didn't really help us, so we quickly recognized that we need to be much more data-centric. And we had a legacy shop, and one of the things the restrictions that we were faced with is that we had a database that is very difficult to add additional data fields to. And we also had, we were reliant on batch job, batch reporting. And so what happens is invariably the state asks for something different and we have the report almost exactly, but we need to change one of the outcome variables. And if we have a fixed report, then we would submit a request and pray for a divine guidance and hope that we could get a report changed in a matter of 3 to 6 months. So it obviously wasn't a good situation for us, and so for me personally at Florida State, I was looking for ways to change the reporting environment. And really what it comes to is, and I don't know what the terms are, but you know, I think of it as surfacing of data. Making data available through data warehouses, providing tools, business intelligence tools, to surface those data so that instead of having the data in the hands of the programmers and having to translate exactly what you're looking for, the ideal for us was that reporting should be in the hands of decision makers. That makes it much more strategic. Data, at least from a strategic enrollment management perspective, we really needed to look at data from various different silos, and so we've had these disparate data sources that we needed to bring together, and so obviously warehousing does that, and of course you all know that. And again, flexible reporting tools allow for flexible outputs, flexible changing and filtering on the reports, and so it just allows for a lot more efficiency in terms of how we report. And quite frankly, from my perspective, if somebody has enough skill to do programming or development, they really shouldn't be doing reporting. That should be for, you know, slightly skilled people like me. So the early BI conceptual models, you know, we're talking really about fairly simple descriptive reporting, you know, student list, list of courses and the like, simple things like aggregations of data, simple crosstabs and the like. You're familiar with all that. What happened at Florida State is as we started getting more data-centric, as we started getting data into the hands of decision makers, what we found is that the access to data actually changed the corporate mindset at the institution. So when one office started coming to the enrollment meetings and providing data as a justification for why they were moving in a certain direction, then other offices started doing the same. But then once you start playing in those data, then you realize that you have different opportunities in terms of what you can do with data. And so it really started changing how we started thinking about reporting. We used to think of reporting as very static. And so we started thinking about, well, if we have all this data, why can't we use data to drive the back end workflow within, say, the admissions office? And so quickly, every morning, somebody in the admissions office would go in and refresh a report, and it would determine what their workflow would be for that day, because it basically queued up what they needed to do. But it was a pull technology. They're still going in and pulling that information. Later we got to where we could schedule that to be sent to them. But then we started taking data and using it more more strategically in terms of predictive modeling. We actually moved our entire decision process for freshman admissions at Florida State. We had a matrix admissions model, quite complex. And basically we're able to model, if we admit this profile of students, then how many of them will show up, how many of them will retain, and so we were able to do some fairly advanced analytics. And so we started, you know, again, we started, the more data we had, the more we as functional people started to use it in a very strategic way in our offices. We also found that there was a need for important point in time information. Where are we this year compared to last year and the year before? What we experienced, though, as we got more familiar with data, is that there are some weaknesses. And quite frankly, as a school with a legacy system, we didn't have data we needed in some areas. My friends are at schools who have legacy, who have vendor solutions, ERP solutions, sometimes those data are available, but they're not defined in a way that you would want them to be. Sometimes data lacks the context. The definition is not what you need. Again, I think with a vendor solution in particular, you know, you get the data are defined as a vendor intended, maybe not as you had intended. And then there's always a question, when I worked with the database administrators, where are the refresh cycles for data? You know, is 24 hours good enough? You know, are there times, well, when you're doing drop ad and you're trying to figure out demand analysis for courses, that's not nearly good enough. And so there are weaknesses that we experienced and hurdles we had to overcome. So the second generation, as I would deem it, for business intelligence is the idea of moving forward into a dynamic business intelligence, pairing business intelligence with CRM, taking the data that you can learn about students and their interests in an institution or their communications with an institution and using those data in some of your strategic reporting. And so you can use that for targeting and targeted marketing and the like. And so pairing that ability to capture data very rapidly and very uniquely for individual students allows us to be much more strategic in terms of how we communicate with them and what information we give them. I mentioned before the interactive decision modeling. Again, it became intrinsic to the process. We changed the entire process of how we evaluated student applications because we had the ability to report on it with this decision model. There's also a need for event-driven reporting. So if a course is generated in the course management system, it's important that somebody knows that that's available then to be scheduled. And so there are event triggers that sometimes we rely on our systems to do that in terms of our applications, but we can also look at business intelligence as a means for triggering off of events and using that. Those same event triggers can be used to update dashboards and the like, and so we're moving into a different generation of business intelligence. And again, I know that a number of you are already using a lot of these types of technologies and features. But we also found, too, that as we went through, that when we look, as we got more familiar with our data, we realized that processes were not always efficient. And so we could look to a workflow process and see where the bottlenecks were. You know, that would really help us out if we could do that and then be able to streamline that and see what's wrong with that part of that process. So we've actually, again, at Florida State, we've changed most of our back office processes by looking at data and seeing where the workflow, where everything piles up, and then looking to find out how we can alleviate those problems. So now we move into kind of maybe the third generation of BI, and this is really taking a different take on business intelligence. And what we found is that there's still, even as we looked at some of the things we just talked on the previous slide, there's still some things that we as people who are looking to get as much as we can out of our data, there are things that we want that we still don't have. And I think in some cases, just as I said before, if you don't have the data, then you can't report off of them. Likewise, if you don't have the correct architectural structures, you might not be able to get the information you want. And so I'm going to hand off here in a second to Scott Thorne, but I want to start by kind of transitioning, saying that traditional systems, are the architecture of those systems, in a sense, predicate how data are formed and how data are captured. And so it does create limitations. And so what we're going to show today is how changing that architectural structure may be able to free up the flexibility of data and metadata in a way that can help us out. And so when we joined this collaboration of Quality Student, the idea was, let's take some of these things that we've all figured out, which is, for starters, we figured out that we didn't really want preloaded reporting that came through our application systems, our ERP systems. So we took an assumption that most reporting would come out of a BI tool. And we didn't say, we don't care which business intelligence tool that would be, but we wanted to make sure that we provided hooks to data that was going to be as rich and robust as possible. So we wanted to look at an architecture that, as it says here, would be change adaptive. And so, as we all know, and that's, you know, we're here at this conference, everything's changing. And so we have to be able to meet those changes. And so one of the changes is we may want to know what type of media channel a person is interacting with our systems using. And so that's an adaptation that we didn't even think about years ago. So the changes in technology are affecting us, but also the changes in expectations. The way we deliver education is changing. The way we define education is changing. And so the whole focus of the Quality Student Project was to make sure that we haven't pinned ourselves in, that we allow ourselves to be as flexible as possible to accommodate change as it comes down the pipe. So with that assumption then, that the data and metadata will change with student information systems and with new architectures, we then set out to figure out how that can affect our reporting. Okay, Scott?
Morning. I'm going to talk about how we used SOA, or are you trying to use SOA, to meet some of the objectives that Rick outlined, and what it means for the reporting landscape. First of all, the main reason we're using SOA is to clearly define integration points and break apart what normally would be a big monolithic SIS system into logical units that we can change and adapt over time without changing the whole system at once. And so we're trying to define all these integration points and get away from sort of the brittle way we used to create systems against one huge database schema. Because changing that database schema had ripple effects throughout the system, which would cause it to evolve very slowly and not adapt well to change. And so the trick with this is putting a service layer between the application and the database that you traditionally have. And that has a lot of impacts on reporting. I've done a lot of warehouse work in the past, and you write ETL tools against the database directly and understand that schema and the metadata there and so forth. But if we started to use that model in an SOA environment, we're going to tie our reporting structure to the underlying database schema, which sort of negates the value of why we're putting services in between, because the services were meant to provide that layer of abstraction so that you could evolve things without being tied to a particular schema. So the big change here is that, you know, the database, you can think of it, the database really isn't something you should rely directly on. It's going to be intermediated with a set of service definitions. And so all your information is going to come through the service definitions, and that's going to be your basis of data access and ultimately reporting. The other difference is, you know, as we were saying, most of the time you think of the student system as one large ERP system and one big database schema. Well, services sort of slice the problem up, and you can't really think of things as all in one database. They're almost slices that are meant to be independent, so we don't have ties, you know, because we're trying to keep it modular and reduce the dependencies. We're trying to reduce the ties across the different domain areas. And so it really changes the way you think about the problem. So here's a picture, you know, where the applications be on top. You know, your persistence layer database is down at the bottom. But in the middle, you've got a layer of services that are around some business domain, like we've got the organization service, the person service, a time period service, etc. And these are what the application uses to interact with the database layer. But the whole point of this is to hide the database layer from the application, and so we'll need to do reporting, we're going to need to do something similar. We don't want to go to the database directly. We want to try to go through that service layer in order to preserve the benefits of the service orientation. So normally, the traditional configurations, we understand the data schemas, tables and columns and metadata, data dictionary around that. With services, going to be quite a bit different. The structure of the service definition isn't the same as a database. So we have to start thinking of the sort of the quote-unquote metadata of the service in a different way. And we need tools, like extraction tools, to work instead of against with SQL and against DBMSs, to work against service definitions instead. And that's beginning to happen now, but it's going to change dramatically how we do data access. And as I said, the it's not a single schema, but many small schemas. Let me just put all words up there. So there's new challenges because of this new way of thinking, but there's also some opportunities that go along with it. One is to try to encapsulate the logic as you transform data as it moves through from reporting. It's what you'd like to do is make sure you have the logic in places that you know about so you can change that in a consistent way and manage it. SOA also helps bring together information from different sources, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But since you have a common definition, let's say what a person service looks like, you might have person information in five different places at your institution, but you can use the service common service definition of person service as a template, really, so that you get a consistent view and can flow the data together in a logical way. The other thing we're doing in Quali Student is handling rules and workflow rather than as application logic as data themselves. So we actually, for instance, want to be able to report on prereq rules. How many courses in our system have Chem 101 as a prereq? And so if we don't, normally that could be just put in application program rules, but then it's not available for reporting. And it's very important if we want to do this new kind of analysis and reporting that Rick was talking about, that you pull that information out so that you can report on it. And the same with workflow. How many requests are in this queue? How fast are we processing the queue? Is there any problems there? If we don't express the workflow in a regular way as data, we won't be able to do that kind of dynamic reporting that Rick was referring to. So here's a quick graphic where you've got an application, looking on the left, the application, and then the service implementation, and you've got that dotted line, which is the service contract that separates the two. So the application only talks to the service implementation through that service contract. That service contract is quite useful, though, because since you've got a well-defined contract, you can actually use it to put a piece of code, that blue box in the middle, and slip a piece of logical code in there and leave the two systems only talking about that service contract. And that's where you can handle the transformation a little easier. For instance, let's say in your system of record, you've got codes in this following these sets of values, but in your reporting system, you really want to translate them through some sort of code mapping to something you're more familiar with on the reporting side. Well, you can build sort of an adapter that knows, all it knows about is I know the two service contracts, and I keep a mapping table, and I, as the data goes through, I know how to map it, and you've encapsulated that problem in one spot. And of course, you can even do it more elaborately. You can do pieces of these so you can layer them together, because you're using the service contract really as a template to look at information of a certain domain in the same manner. And then here's a representation of the situation I was talking about before. If you, for instance, with person data, you might have alumni data in the blue box and HR data in the purple box, and they can each express their information through a common service contract. And most of the time, an alumni application would only talk to the bottom service contract and deal with that. But in certain cases for reporting, you might need to blend that data together. And so you can build an adapter that takes the two sets of information, and since they're all in the same sort of structure, just have the logic that merges them up to a reporting consumer up above. So the idea here is because you've got a pattern for thinking about, in this example, person information, then it allows you to segment your business logic in places and manage it correctly. Now, as far as technology, this I showed it here in a stack, but that stack could be a DAPL or anything else. It's not necessarily a quick software stack. That could be any number of technologies that follow this adapter pattern. We want to give you Stuart Sim is going to give a demo of how we've done a proof of concept to try to use the ETL tools against the service definitions we've created for the first module in Qali Student. So here we've gotten to the stage where we've defined services for person and for organization, et cetera, et cetera. Now, can we actually take an ETL tool and have it access the information we've got in the system through the service interfaces only? That's sort of the first step in the evolution of this idea and how we architect the system out.
First thing I'm going to try and do is swap my computer in on here, so we'll just test to see how well Vista does its display setting adjustment. Is everyone or anyone using, as a show of hands, business intelligence tools on campus? Okay, quite a few. Anyone, I guess, SAS? Anyone using SAS? Cognos, I guess, or business office, okay. And anyone familiar with the term ETL tool? Yeah, okay. Good, so let's see how well this live demo goes. I had it set up on this other machine, so let's see how well this works. Who's deliriously happy with the results they're getting from their current business intelligence tool? Who's moderately happy? Who's getting the results that they want? Who's unhappy with the level of access they can get to their own data on their campus? I had somebody, I had somebody install Windows 7 on their machine the other day, and a little pop-up, I'm pretty sure it was malware, but it popped up and said, this is your new blue screen of death, but it didn't actually blue screen, it just popped up and said, welcome to blue screen. He was horrified, it was like 12 hours after he installed it. Okay, here we go. So, what Scott was describing was the abstraction, the layering of services within the Qali architecture. The point is that just with all of the Qali projects, it's all about choice, and with the collaborative source projects. So, as part of the demonstration work that we put up, Qali has just gone through a milestone release where a number of those services, a particular organization, a number of the domains have been released as SOA services, and we're currently testing how well that SOA architecture works with different types of reporting tools that we know are out in the market. And I've been using a number of different open source ETL tools and business intelligence tools to test how well we can get access to that data. Because we know that with the deployment of Qali Student, everyone's going to have a different mix of different reporting tools, different ETL environments, and what we want to do is demonstrate how you can use combinations of those tools, depending on what you already have running on your campus, to get access to that data. What I have here, this is actually my wiki environment within the Kuali project. I'm just going to show you here some of the screenshots I used with Talend. So Talend is an open source ETL tool. Another popular one is Pendaho. In this case, we use Talend because it's widely adopted at UBC, one of the lead universities in the project. So let me see if I can zoom in here. Has anyone heard of Talend or familiar with it? It's just like any other ETL tool. ETL is a extraction translation acronym. So what we're doing here in this particular screenshot, let me see if I can I move that over? This is a screenshot here where I've defined the web service endpoint here for the organizations within the Kuali student services. So the Kuali SOA environment is exposing the organization list here, or actually organization type list. And I'm defining my operation that I want to extract that data from that endpoint. Because it's delivered as a decoupled web service, excuse me, I can just point this tool at the web services description language and I can extract that data out. So what this tool is doing, just what this screenshot here is showing, is I've said I've defined this deployed service endpoint for Kuali. I want to see all the organizations and I'm extracting that into a single row, into actually a log file here. Now let's see if I can, okay. So, for the diehards out there, this is the WSDL, the web services description language of what organizations look like. I'm going to zoom in here. Now, the screen resolution isn't helping me here, but this is the actual endpoint of that web service. So what we've done is deployed the organization as a service, the organization service, and then we're saying, this is the web services description endpoint for that web service. So point your ETL tool at that, and you can extract it. The security model by default within Kuali at the moment is KeyStore, which is a common security model for web services. So you can just configure your tool to say, this is who I am. This is my KeyStore authentication. Please extract all those organizations for me. And then what we're doing, we can then push them into any data warehouse component that we want to. In my case, I'm pulling them out into a log file system. And let's see if this is a screenshot here of Talend actually running the job. Okay, so this is just like any other ETL tool. If you have a something like any other business intelligence environment, the first process for building out your data warehouse is consolidating that information into either DataMart or consolidated data warehouse. So you're pointing your ETL tool, your data extraction tool, at the endpoints for Kuali, pulling them all into your data warehouse, and then you can provide your reports on top. So this again is the first stage of that process. What the screenshot here is showing is my Kuali org types web service adapter, just there. Let me zoom in on that. There we go. So I've pulled out my 17 rows here. It didn't take very long. And those are the types of organizations I'm seeing within the Kuali student setup. And I've written them out to an XML file. The next stage of that is once I have my, this is Firefox not behaving itself. Okay, so the next, once I've run that job and I've collected them all into my DataMart, I can then run my reporting tool of choice. So here, this is a sample of the files actually pulled out. This is the XML file that's been created by pointing at that endpoint. I can then take that XML file and stick it into my whatever data warehouse I'm running. What I've done here is I've built a proof of concept reporting application. So what we're trying to demonstrate here is the layering concept that Scott was talking about. I've got my Kuali data deployed as discrete services throughout the campus, And I can pick and choose which where I want to access that information, which applications get access to that application, that data. And I can also develop my own applications on top, so customized reporting to get access to those endpoints. So here, this is just a very simple application that is accessing those web services endpoints. So that XML file that you just saw just now is this application is pointing to the same web service endpoint and rendering it here as a simple application. Now this is just showing the org type list as one of the components, one of the domains that's delivered out of the current release, the milestone release. So here I can go and I can create a new org type. Now the point of the web service, this is meant to be a proof of concept as a reporting application, so it would be one way. In my case here, what I've done is create a two-way application. So I can go and create new entities here and actually push them back into the system, which is more of the demonstration of the services abstraction. So I can have multiple user interfaces to those underlying services. What I wanted to show here, this is the same. So for this application here, this is the web services description language endpoint for the application that I just showed you. And it's delivering on the same signatures for the web services endpoints that we saw for the Qali org type service. The point being that diagram that Scott showed you, where the multiple instances of a organization object can have different interfaces, and you can use different tools to access those. And so you can pick and choose which of your reporting applications you want to show against that data. Or again, build your own. Here I have a couple of kind of sample business intelligence reports. These are data sets that aren't yet currently populated. It's a sample data set that's not quite populated in the domain of Qali. But what I wanted to show was an example of some of the widely available open source reporting tool sets that you can use to layer on top of that data set. So, you know, here these are the same sorts of reports that you would see out of your existing business intelligence tools, but by taking these this reporting framework and layering it on top of the same sets of services that are exposed out of those decoupled services, you can then build your reporting data model on top of that. So, sample pie charts, the same sorts of reports you'd expect to see out of your student information system, OLAP cubes, export to Excel. Student enrollment numbers, fund appropriation, and these are their data sets that we're going to see being put into the Qali environment. So with that, we hope to leave it open with some Q&A and discussion around what sort of tools are being used on campus, what your frustrations are with existing BI tool environments, and see if we can share some experiences about of what we've done. So first off, any I guess questions for any of us in the presentation or what we've shown here?
And if I can, one of the challenges, and in the interest of time, we didn't go through all aspects of the Qali project, but one of the challenges of the Qali project was to create a framework as opposed to a point solution. So instead of buying a vendor solution that you then modify or customize to make it meet your needs, or you change your process to and your data definitions to meet its definitions or its constraints, the intent here is to build a framework that allows each institution to define things. MIT defines courses and programs in a way that no other university does. And so the great value of what we're doing is we're actually allowing each institution to define how data are represented and the relations among data. And so what we've done is we've done a kind of a first blush to see what that landscape looks like. We have those in repositories within the project, and then each school at a point of implementation would determine, do they want to in a sense model copy off of what we've collected or what some other school has done, or do they want to define everything themselves as they would have it? And so there's an opportunity and a challenge there. One is you can make the software meet your needs completely, or you can find a compromise in the middle that says, okay, we'll change some of our processes, maybe to be more efficient. And, you know, so that's the real challenge here is really defining you know, it's defining all those rules. And what we've done is we've given a head start by simply documenting what is going on at the 10 institutions that are involved in the Quality Project. Did that get close to your answer? The interesting thing about the nature design here is we didn't need to have a full checklist of all FITGAP requirements. We simply needed to know, in a generic sense, what was the modal case for how an operation would work for, say, registration, and then what were the edge cases? What were things that would potentially break a traditional software deployment? And so from a service team, and Scott and I, well, all three of us were on the service design team, the service design team really needed to know at a little bit higher level what that functionality was, and then looked for the commonalities across all the different modules so you could make generic services. The granularity then was left to a use case development team that really, again, started setting up repositories of very granular type details that were institution specific. Okay, any other questions?
I was just going to add just real quickly to the end of that previous question. The real answer is it's difficult, and the hardest part of the business intelligence reporting rollout, as you guys all know, is there's a huge technology hurdle, and often that's used as as an excuse almost, it's to not have to answer those difficult questions. What we're trying to do here with lowering that barrier to get to lower the hurdle for the technology solutions is to try and start asking people those difficult questions early on. So, what is it you want to know of the system before and currently? You know, you bring in either Expense or a heavyweight application framework for your business intelligence, and you get shown the default reports that get installed as part of the system. And then there's a huge effort for data cleanliness, data cleanup, understanding what data you've got. And that often is a precursor to anything that you've got to do to actually design a report in the first place. But it's not easy. And one of the things that the Quality Project is trying to do is define a set of common data sets that are relevant to different schools and different domains, so medium-size, large-scale universities, other community colleges. So at least start with a seed data set so that you can see those difficult questions. Because just approaching somebody out of the blue and saying, what is it you want to see? What data set would you like to see out of the system? Often people don't know even what's available in the system, and so you have to try and seed those conversations. Sorry, there was another question. Yes. Yeah. That was one of the goals. So, one of the deliverables out of Quality Student is the Quality Reference University data set, which I think is incredibly useful because you at your campus you know exactly what your data domains are. The example that Rick gave. MIT calls a course something different. So you're going to have to do your own kind of language taxonomy mapping. But there's a good seed data set to help you with that exercise. And then, depending on what your technology setup is on your campus, you're going to look to all the documentation as well as the code set and some of an example like the ETL tool that I showed there. You're going to then do your translation and your mapping to whatever tools you already have. I mean, the point of the community source project is not throw away and replace, but it's to enable you to make best use of what you have there. So the reason why it was built as a service, a level of abstracted services, is knowing that you already have a bunch of stuff already on campus. You know, this isn't something you download and install, you know, as a one-off monolithic application. It's building on what you already have. And so a lot of the work, the design work and the deliverables are geared with that in mind. And one of the things I focus on particularly is understanding how is it going to integrate with some of those applications or that you already have in campus. So that includes technology stacks and other frameworks. And so, reporting in particular, we know that the schools have already invested in a whole suite of different technologies, whether it's Microsoft or Java or and other programming skill sets as well. And so we're trying to work through the deliverables so that they work for a wide as wide a base as possible. hooking into your existing identity management system and other core infrastructure products that you already have on campus. But, and the project is also soliciting feedback from schools to try and help make that that information as useful as possible. I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Oh yeah, yes. So the information model. It's so the question was how flexible is the access permission model within the system. So that's something that actually Scott has spent an awful lot of time on within the services layer, defining and mapping to common best practice with identity management patterns, looking at the party person principle patterns, having abstracted authorization rules. And one of the things that I've been looking at is how do you plug that into common identity management systems that are deployed on campus, whether they're open source systems or commercial providers, Oracle, Sun, IBM's, whatever identity system you have. So whatever authorization mechanism you already have on campus is setting the permission structures so that they'll work with that infrastructure. If you already have an identity management program in place on campus and whatever that implementation is, we're looking at from the deployment perspective how well we can integrate into those patterns. So some because everyone's different, right? Some are just defined in as LDAP roles. Some are more sophisticated within a full blown identity management suite.
All right, that's it for time. We appreciate you coming here. If you would fill out an evaluation, we certainly appreciate it. We will also stand around. I know this is a bit abstract, so we'll stand around and try to answer any questions that you may have at this point in time. But we certainly appreciate you coming this morning, and hope you have a safe trip home. Thank you.